We do not have a quorum yet, obviously. But we have an abbreviated schedule, so I'm going to have Representative Downey start his testimony, and then I'll break once we have enough folks for a quorum, and then we'll move the bill after that. So if you want to just start talking your bill, Representative Downey, and then we'll move it. And for clarity, does it need to go just to the floor after this?
I believe the motion would be to re-refer to State Government Finance. Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're dealing with House File 1234, and very brief background. This bill was authored in the Senate and co-authored by me here in the House. It actually advanced into the Senate State Government Finance Omnibus Bill, and we, due to timing, actually introduced it as well in our State Government Finance Omnibus Bill, but are hearing it now and re-referring it back over to the State Government Finance Bill, just so that the Government Operations Committee has heard it and had a chance to weigh in on the provisions. And very briefly, members, the bill is designed to have the administration have an outside firm who specializes in sourcing and procurement operations come in and do an assessment. They can do these fairly rapidly, especially now that we have our SWIFT accounting system in place and all of our procurement data is kind of in the aggregate, sitting in presumably one database. This will be a much easier process for the outside firm. The firms will typically do this on a no-charge basis, recognizing that if they identify savings opportunities, that they'll have an opportunity to come in and on a success fee basis help to drive those savings into the organization and be rewarded on a percentage basis or some kind of value-based basis for the output that they actually produce. So just to briefly describe the span of what we're contemplating here, when you think about procurement, many times you think about issuing a purchase order, receiving product, and then billing the vendor. Strategic sourcing actually attempts to look at the entire chain from the beginning. What are the commodities and the products that we need and should be sourcing from vendors, contracting for those, determining the amounts of inventory and where that inventory should be stored, then all the way down through the actual procurement process, through the delivery, and then through the actual supplier payments. And so there's a big opportunity there. You will typically find, depending on the commodity that you're purchasing, in large organizations that maybe haven't done a lot of this or have just started, anywhere from 5 to up to 15% in those commodity categories. I have heard the number $2 billion of state spending. I've heard a number of $4 billion of state spending. I don't know what commodity classes and services are or are not included in those numbers, but clearly the state of Minnesota spends a lot of money. And so if you think about realizing even kind of average or typical returns from a project like this, even 5 to 10% of $2 to $4 billion is a lot of money. Anywhere north of $100 million even if we did this and actually realized savings. So with that, let me just talk very briefly about the kinds of things that are typically looked at. There's project elimination and deferral. Lots of departments have lots of projects, and looking at them and prioritizing them can actually yield a benefit of 25 to 50% of projects being deferred or eliminated. Those are projects that are sitting out there in the queue, which with a little scrutiny can be refined. If you look at vendor renegotiations, renegotiating the contracts with suppliers to drive down our spending, you can oftentimes find 3 to 5%, and again, in some commodity classes, if we haven't done a lot of work in this in the past, could be even up to 15% savings. Process streamlining, where you actually optimize the overall sourcing and procurement processes across state government. We have a new SWIFT accounting system that I believe, according to the administration, is largely supporting procurement and accounts payable operations. The vendor contracts, in theory, are all housed in that system now. The ability to actually streamline approvals and make sure that the electronic routings are optimized and that we've kind of looked at the global staffing and management of the procurement function. One would hope that on the back end of the SWIFT implementation project that a lot of that work was already done, but there could be some opportunities there. And then on the supplier payment audit side, just missed billings and making sure you catch things oftentimes can lead to a tenth of a percent in savings. So that's literally millions of dollars just by making sure we have the right mechanisms in the system and the right controls in place to audit the supplier payments. So, members, that's the overall approach here. It is designed to not cost the state anything. On the upfront, the vendor would come in and do the data extraction and run the data against their systems and their national benchmarks. Commissioner Badgero, back 2 years ago when she testified about the SWIFT implementation and talked about the actual return on investment, actually highlighted this area as probably the major return on investment area. And I know the department has done some work on this, and we'll hear from them. And so this isn't to discredit anything the department has done. It's to say there's probably an additional opportunity here. Bring in the outside resources and put a little bit of a turbocharge on what's happening with the strategic sourcing area and realize the benefits.
Okay. Well, we do have a quorum now, so I will call, I will call the meeting to order. Can I have a motion for approval of the minutes of March 16th?
Madam Chair, I would move to approve the motion or the minutes for March 16th.
Representative Baum moves for the approval of the minutes of Wednesday, March 16th. Any questions or comments? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Representative Murray.
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 1234 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee.
Representative Murray moves that House File 1234 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Representative Downey, did you want to take questions now, or did you have any witnesses?
I do not have any witnesses, and I'll defer to you, Madam Chair, as to whether or not questions from the members would be better as compared to, I know the department wants to speak okay. to the bill.
I think then we'll have the department come up and talk, and then we'll let members filter in here, and then we'll take questions. Welcome to the
Madam
committee,
Chair,
Mr. Allen.
Representative Downey. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Director of the Materials Management Division, Chief Procurement Officer for the state. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak, appreciate the opportunity to appreciate what you're doing to be creative with budget solutions and recognizing that strategic sourcing is potentially a helpful concept to incorporate into those discussions. As I look at the bill, though, one of the reasons I wanted to have the opportunity to speak to you on this is because I think it appears to present a easier or maybe more comprehensive solution than will prove to be reality. Representative Downey generously mentioned that the state of Minnesota already has been doing some work in the strategic procurement area. In fact, we have won some awards for our work in the area. A major focus of Governor Pawlenty's drive to excellence was, in fact, strategic sourcing. And that initiative began with a consulting engagement with Deloitte Consulting and then moved into a very intense five-year operation managed by state employees. And the work that we've done has been nationally recognized. Probably the best single example of that is the report of the Pew Center on the States, which they completed in May of 2010. They issued a report called States Buying Smarter, Lessons in Purchasing and Contracting from Minnesota and Virginia. I certainly don't intend to say that there's no room for improvement in Minnesota. There always is. We try to operate on from a perspective of continuous improvement. But clearly, much of the low-hanging fruit with respect to strategic procurement has been picked. As Representative Downey talked about some of the areas for opportunity, he talked about project elimination and deferral. That's actually one that we've been in conversations with Commissioner Kronk about, because we would agree that that's an area where we think there may be opportunity, particularly as a new administration comes in and is able to look at projects that were initiated previously. Negotiations is an area that we certainly agree is useful, But we have an outstanding track record in Minnesota and have been written up nationally with respect to the work we're already doing in negotiations. Certainly Representative Downey's correct in the belief that the SWIFT program is an attempt to streamline processes. The reality is that the SWIFT program isn't going to be fully implemented in July of this year as initially planned. Much of the procurement functionality has been deferred. So some of the data advantages that we're counting on from the SWIFT system will not be available as soon as we might have hoped. And then one area that Representative Downey mentioned where I agree there's a good opportunity is the whole issue of vendor audit. That's one where, frankly, we haven't had the resources or opportunity to pursue that to the degree we might, and there could well be some opportunity there. One of the things I did want a chance to mention is that as other states have taken on strategic procurement initiatives with external vendors, the results have often been poor, and unfortunately in several instances have ended up in contract disputes and litigation. I think there are a couple reasons for that. One is simply the fact that it's very difficult to determine the value added by the strategic procurement consultant in a context where there are many, many variables in terms of the price that the state pays for goods and services. So the amount that can be credited to a contractor is often very, very difficult to compute and somewhat subjective. And secondly, even when the state and the contractor can agree on the amount that has been saved, state systems are generally not designed very well to recapture those savings, which are spread across many, many agencies and local units of government, and pay those to a sourcing consultant. Let me mention just a couple examples of instances where these external contracts have been a disappointment. State of California, 2008, headline from the Sacramento Bee reads, State Contracts Overhaul in Tatters. New Mexico firm hired to help the effort was let go, unpaid, and is suing. Similar problems in Illinois. A report from the Heartland Institute, which is an organization advocating lower taxes, balanced budgets, and limited government, commented on the effort in Illinois. And a quote from their report reads, An Illinois agency that claims to have saved taxpayers $600 million by reducing waste and fraud has itself wasted money, granted multi-million dollar contracts to politically connected firms, and failed to show that it has saved money, according to a blistering audit by the Illinois Auditor General. Iowa in 2008, the Des Moines Register has a headline that says state officials paid an out-of-state contractor $882,000 to help save Iowa $50,000 a year, according to an audit released Monday. In New Mexico, state auditors found that the savings generated by a strategic sourcing consultant were wiped out by the payments to the company. In West Virginia, a contract was canceled by the governor after the media reported the compensation levels of individuals in the company that had received the contract. And lastly, in Wisconsin, several state agencies disputed the savings that were claimed by the strategic sourcing consultants, refused to return the money to the general fund that was demanded by their administration, and the contract was ultimately canceled with a decision to have the state employees do the work. One would ask whether we could do better than that in Minnesota. I mean, I certainly hope that's the case. I'd like to believe we do most things better in Minnesota. Actually, one aspect of this that has led to the most sort of intriguing discussion within my division is that there's some state employees who are kind of excited about the prospect that they could maybe compete for this work. Over the years, we've frequently kind of joked with one another about the fact that we'd like to be working on commission, and this perhaps gives our more enterprising employees some opportunity to do that. Just one example of how that could play out. We have an attorney negotiator in our division that's negotiated contract price reductions in excess of $24 million in the 50 months that he's worked for us. His compensation for that as a public employee, salary and benefits, equaled $325,000. If we'd been paying him on even a 10% commission for his efforts, we would have paid him $2.4 million. So, as the example shows, a contract in this area has some potential to make some of my colleagues fairly wealthy. And you may or may not see that as a good thing, but I think generally the state perspective would be that it's unfortunate if we're paying much more money to the same people to do the work that they're doing now. Representative Downey mentioned Dana Badgerow and her, she clearly is a widely respected reform-oriented commissioner who served both Governor Carlson and Governor Plenty. And as I was doing some background on this bill, I ran across a couple of emails that Dana had sent me when the problems with the contract blew up in Iowa. And it was interesting to see a couple years later now what she'd said. And one of them said, regarding the Iowa sourcing scandal, aren't we glad we did this on our own, achieved measurably greater results, and made the standards mandatory? And then when the Commissioner of Administration was attacked in the press over this contract, Dana wrote, thank you all for sparing me a similar criticism. So, and likewise, I thank all of you for the opportunity to provide some comments and additional context on a most intriguing bill.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comments will be very brief. Representative Downey, thank you once again for taking on a task of trying to figure out how to build a better mousetrap, shall we say, here in the state of Minnesota. My comments are to the witness. Is there some way that you can see within the Department of Administration right now and the good work that you folks do that there could be some help to you in furthering this cause, that the legislature could enact laws or provide resources to be able to help you become more efficient in that? I think sometimes that it's like a push from the legislature instead of a pull from administration, and I'd like to have a partnership on that if we can. And so you heard it today, I thought I would just ask that question.
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I think there's certainly opportunities. The one I mentioned previously, which I guess I would say is the what I view as the best untapped opportunity, is that vendor audit piece. We have developed some contracts in partnership with other states that would provide some consulting services on the whole vendor audit issue. And I think we're looking at trying to take advantage of those. The contract that Representative Downey is discussing could perhaps be similarly leveraged to pursue that angle. I mean, that's one where I think the when you're finding missed billings or overbillings by a vendor, it's substantially easier to compensate that vendor for the work they've done there than it is in the more subjective area where you're trying to determine how much they saved the state in terms of the price paid. So I think that's a good opportunity area.
Thank you, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, we've traded lots of emails in the past, and I do have a constituent who does some printing for the state and a nice private business. But, you know, because of the use of the vendor system, I just have to mention this on his behalf, because of the use of the vendor system, a vendor who has a Minnesota address is simply shipping printing jobs across state lines and other places. So I guess my main concern is outsourcing. And I can't tell from this proposal if we might be outsourcing IT or something to China or India, because you know, if our goal is to reduce spending, and certainly I'm in favor of that, but I'm not favoring using desperate people who work cheap. So can you tell me what in this provision would prevent the state from outsourcing a process or some type of system to China or India?
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, I don't think there's anything specifically in the bill that would prevent that, although I certainly don't believe that's the intent of the bill. And as the state implements something like this, we would certainly want to apply our sort of general common sense and good judgment as well and make sure that there aren't additional unintended consequences like that. One interesting issue, though, with respect to strategic sourcing in general is that it does tend to put whoever's making some of these decisions in the position of trying to balance the cost savings potential, which usually involves fewer contracts to larger firms, with the sort of business development and support of Minnesota's small business issue, which sometimes can run contrary to the strategic sourcing approaches that are generally in place. And that's one of the things the Department of Administration wrestles with constantly, because we want to try to be faithful to both those principles, but finding the balance is a bit of a challenge.
Representative Scalzi.
I heard you say that it doesn't prevent it, and that we would be using common sense and good intentions and finding the balance. Those are scary words to me when I'm worried about outsourcing to China or India, where desperate people work cheap. They're very scary words to me. And I guess, you know, my party doesn't have the votes to stop something like that this year, so we just sort of let it go. But how does this bill differ from what we discussed in the state government finance bill last night? And maybe Representative Downey can answer that.
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, the language in this bill is in the state government finance omnibus bill.
Representative Scalzi.
And that's what I thought. So why are we doing this here when we passed it on the House floor yesterday? You have to excuse me, because we were up until 3 in the morning arguing on the Capitol, being yelled at. So it's just a little hard to kind of understand if this was in that bill and why is it here. Maybe you could address that.
Representative Downey.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, we won't yell today, but
one day off.
Madam Chair, the intention here was to make sure that the bill was fairly heard in government operations. If it should end up in a final omnibus state government finance bill, it was deemed appropriate and important to have it heard in the Government Operations Committee as well, so that this committee would have had a full chance to vet the provisions of the bill and make sure that your opinion is considered as part of the conference committee and ultimate negotiation process with the governor's office.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then we passed the omnibus bill last night, and granted, then this maybe shouldn't have been a part of that bill, but your party decided that it was a part of that bill, and it passed. So now we're going backwards and having the hearing on it so that the public has some input today after it already passed last night. Can you sense the frustration of the obfuscation of the process here? And is that a question of Representative Downey? I don't know. I'm frustrated.
I understand your frustration. Well, I'll let Representative Downey answer that in a second. I think that there's a slight possibility that the governor may veto the state government finance bill. I don't know. I haven't heard one way or the other. It's possible. And it's not. I don't think it's uncommon for bills to take more than one route through the process. I mean, frequently, Representative Kahn was one of my mentors here when I was able to observe her placing her provisions in five or six bills, and she even talked to me about that when I was a freshman, how that process worked. So I guess that would be my kind of overall comment on that, but I'll let Representative Downey address it as well.
Well, Madam Chair, I defer to you in terms of the routing of the bills, but just to the comment that the bill hadn't had a fair hearing, it was heard in the Senate, included in the Senate omnibus state government finance bill. It was heard in state government finance and included in our bill and debated thoroughly on the floor of both chambers. So I think to the extent that the bill didn't get a public hearing, I don't think that is a fair characterization. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scalzi.
But did this committee hear it before, Ms. Chair, do you know? Or is this the first time that this committee has heard this bill?
I believe this is, Representative Scalzi, I believe this is the first time this committee has heard the bill, and I wanted to hear this bill because I felt that the committee members would like to see the bill. So as a courtesy to this committee, I felt that it was important, although it was in the state government. As you know, I'm not on state government finance, but I felt this is something that should be heard in this committee as well, and it can travel its own separate route, and that's not an uncommon, unusual occurrence in this body.
But, Mr. Chair, isn't that kind of a backwards to hear it in state government finance and then to send it? Don't we typically hear the bills first as a policy and then they go to state government finance?
Well, Representative Scalzi, as I mentioned, I'm not on state government finance, so I can't, it's not my responsibility to put the state government finance bill and together, and whatever Chair Lanning decided to put in the state government bill is not in my purview. All I know is that I felt that this was something that our committee would like to see, and whether or not the process is what you like, I think that frequently things are amended on the floor, and as long as I've been here, I've never seen a 100% fluid process on any bill process. So, you know, I could have just said, well, let's not see it at all. Obviously, nobody said anything last night, and we could have just not heard it at all. But I did feel it was a courtesy to hear it here and allow this bill to travel on its own as well, in the rare occurrence that there may be a veto to the state government finance bill. So.
And I appreciate that you wanted to see it, and so I'm glad that you did put it here. I'm just talking about the process.
Right. And
thank you.
Again, it's different purview. Representative Beard?
Madam Chair, yeah, I just Representative Scalzi made a few comments, and I want to respond to those and talk about them for a moment. Because we talked about India and China. We've scored them now several times here this morning already, and I know we've only had 3 or 4 hours of sleep, but it's a theme that I hear coming up over and over again when I hear us, of course we're proud of our state, comparing ourselves to other places in the nation and in the world. Most commonly we compare ourselves to Mississippi or Alabama or Louisiana, and usually in a disparaging way to those folks. Here I've just heard us compare ourselves to India and China several times, desperate people who work cheap. Members, I want to encourage you to remember that beating in the breast of every human being is the ability to live free and to be rewarded for your work. They have the same aspirations that we do for a better life for themselves and their kids. And as their economies, thankfully, start to catch up with the rest of the world, let me point out to you that they catch up because this country has been a beacon on a hill, a city on a hill that's been a shining example of what can happen when you actually turn loose just a little bit of the free market and the ability for people to shake off the caste system or the oppression of some tyranny like communism and actually grab a hold of their own bootstraps and try to improve their lives. I wish we wouldn't disparage those people for what they're trying to do. The city of Bangalore is an outstanding example of what happened when one little part of India, which is a pretty hidebound culturally and from the caste system and everything else that they've had from a couple centuries of colonial rule, those people decided not to wallow in feeling sorry for themselves, and they've actually taken on very much an American capitalistic way of life. Those people are not desperate. They're enthusiastic. They're competent. They put some of us to shame with the way they take on their schooling, the ability to learn English for one reason. They're very proud of that. And they just go gangbusters, competing for business all over the world. In China, which has been pretty much a closed society for several centuries and, of course, under the thumb of communism for at least 80 years. Members, the Chinese communists recognized they couldn't keep people from fleeing to Hong Kong. So you know what they did? They created a little, prefect, I think is the term, just across the hill from Hong Kong, and they named it Shenzhen. And they gave them special dispensations to own property, negotiate for their own wages, and start a capitalistic society. That is the most flourishing city in China today, and a city that is an amazing place to visit. Prospering, their wage inflation is growing in double digits because people are flocking to town looking for work. And guess what the Chinese are doing now? They're complaining about the Vietnamese, because the Vietnamese, they say, are desperate people who will work for cheap, and they're stealing their jobs. Those of us that have been around the block a few times have seen this before. I remember the Japanese scourge. Whenever I was a kid, we were terrified the Japanese were going to clean our clocks. And then it was the Taiwanese. But as those countries became more prosperous and their prices came up, then we were all afraid of South Korea. Well, how's South Korea doing now? They're actually importing stuff from China as well. China and India are just the next step on the ladder. They're right behind us. So I would encourage us to actually cheer for those people. And please let's be considerate whenever we're trying to compare ourselves to others. As proud as we are of Minnesota, and as much as we want to be protective, members, those are people too. They're human beings that are improving their lot in life because they want to, and we should really be pretty proud of that and cheer for them. Thank you for indulging me with a few comments to that point.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a lot to respond to in terms of Representative Beard's comments, but yeah, I love their high-speed rail system over in China, and so hopefully we can emulate that major investment that they've done. And Madam Chair, thanks for the extra hour. I don't know, it's going to help me be more coherent, but I have a couple of questions either to the witness or the author. I see in the bill that there are there's a report that's required. There's the preparation of an RFP. How much staff time is required in the department for that? And do you know approximately what the cost would be for to implement House File 1234?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, we received a fiscal note that included two FTEs, if I remember right, for 2 years. The scope of the intended scope of the language in the bill is that this would be a fairly rapid assessment. Most vendors can perform that in maybe a 3-month time period if they have to do a little more data aggregating across databases and things that might take a little longer. So the scope of this is not designed to require much, if any, staff time. Clearly, the state staff will need to coordinate with the contractor being on site or extracting their data and confirm the report outputs from the vendor. But we have a fiscal note. It was included as part of the state government finance omnibus bill. I don't know that I think it's as long or as big as the department thought.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. And then just one more follow-up, Representative Downey. Mr. Allen had given some examples about how, you know, this type of thing has become, you know, maybe we could describe it as a gravy train for consultants in some of these other states. Do you have any ways that we could guarantee that it won't turn into that here? Stop gaps. Seems like there were some abuses, maybe some contracts that were inflated. You know, I was very concerned about some of these examples, West Virginia, other places. Is there any thought you have, Representative Downey, about making sure that doesn't happen here? I don't see any kind of language in the bill that would, you know, give me comfort that we wouldn't be just creating yet another gravy train for consultants.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein. You know, we don't prescribe the exact contract language in terms of the share and savings nature of the eventual contract. If there were enough identified savings to justify proceeding with an actual contract, you can always find examples of failures all over the place. You can find plenty of examples of success, too. I have some that I could relate to you here as well. But my experience in previous life as a consultant was that there are typically lots of controls and lots of mechanisms to very clearly define where the contractor can be credited for the savings as compared to where they aren't. There are lots of caps, percentages of different categories of spend savings. Those contracts can be pretty artfully done in a way that I think limits the state's ultimate liability and also the fees as well. So to characterize this as another gravy train for contractors, frankly, I think is a bit of an insult to the people who would actually write the contract at the state. I don't imagine they would be interested in creating a gravy train.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks. One last comment then and question. You know, there's so much prescriptive language in this, you know, mandates, et cetera. So I just was curious as to why there wasn't even some prescriptive language on in terms of, you know, again, ensuring that what happened in other states wouldn't happen here. But last question would be on line 14. Prescribe or give examples about, you know, what types of services we want to contract for in terms of getting some advice. And so one is contract consolidation, and then on line 14, and then the other one was negotiations. What would be an example of the types of information we would want to get in terms of contract consolidation, and then separately negotiations. What are we fishing for? What are we looking for in those two areas of interest of yours?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hornstein, and we may want to hear from the testifier too. So typically what happens in large organizations that are highly dispersed and distributed is that you have lots of one-off contracts for specialized purposes that then end up having a life of their own, and lots of procurement gets done off of those. And so aggregating down to a short list of vendors typically gives you a purchasing power to negotiate better contracts. So large organization like the state, projects I've done in other places, you literally can have dozens, if not hundreds, of vendors that you're buying the exact same product from. And so rationalizing that vendor pool down to a very small number, making it not so small that you don't have competitive bidding possible, negotiating contracts, doing things through reverse auctions and other advanced procurement techniques is what we'd be driving at. And the department may want to speak to how much they might already have done. The comment made that they haven't actually implemented the full procurement suite on the SWIFT system would tell me that maybe there's an opportunity there once all that data does get aggregated and we can look at those contracts side by side to do more of that. I can't speak to the specific opportunity that may or may not be there, but that's what we're talking about.
And then negotiations.
Representative Bornstein.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, or Mr. Allen, what kind of advice are you looking for on negotiation?
Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein, the large firms that do this nationally and internationally in terms of kind of benchmarking the state, they will have an ability after they extract and synthesize the state's data to benchmark what the state is doing against other contracts that they're aware of. And in fact, some large procurement specialty organizations actually have contracts that organizations can adopt and ride onto. So there's a lot of opportunity there in terms of negotiations. And again, you rely on the state's procurement folks to participate in that as well. So this isn't as though the outside vendor comes in and negotiates the contract for the state. Clearly, the procurement function still resides here. Procurement rules and guidelines still apply. It's just taking advantage of a national, international scope of benchmarking and best practices and data that they've aggregated over the years that benefits the state.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Murray.
Well, I have the honor today to have in the audience my dad and mom, Richard and Ruth Murray from Claremont, Minnesota. Yeah. And welcome. Glad to have you here, as always. So,
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you. That was so delightful. Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondered, and I'm sorry, I think this is kind of the haze of last night's activities. How is this different from what's already going on at the Department of Administration? And maybe you could both answer the question.
Sure, I'll answer first because I can explain what's contemplated in the bill. So, Madam Chair and Representative Green, the thought is that an outside organization with a national and international practice area and some of the tools and the contracting ideas and the highly specialized business process reengineering and procurement reengineering and auditing capabilities would be able to add some value to the department. It is not intended to replace the department. It's intended to be additive, and to the extent that the outside contractor can bring some real value and the department can take advantage of it, they would. We may want to hear from the department in terms of their perspective of how it would work, but that's what is intended in the bill.
Mr. Green, or Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative Green. The way in which I may disagree with Representative Downey on this would just be the extent to which these things are already occurring. I mean, as I said, we started off with Deloitte as a consultant in this area and have had a very, very aggressive strategic procurement program in place for the last 5 years. But that's not to say there's not always room to do some things better and to learn from other public sector agencies and private sector consultants. And again, I've said this before, but the one area to me which I think has the most untapped potential is the vendor audit issue, because that's something where we haven't devoted considerable energy to it. We have in the other areas that are being discussed.
Representative Green.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Green. Just maybe one other comment. We actually didn't book any savings from this activity in our state government finance bill because of the very discussion we're having. I think it's the department has been on an effort. We certainly respect that and appreciate that, and they've got some demonstrable results. You know, you look at other organizations and you think about, 5 to 10% kinds of savings in general for projects like this. Is there an opportunity? We think so, but certainly didn't want to presume so to the extent that we would actually book savings. So,
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up, actually, exactly to that point. Did we book cost? As soon as I hear the words Deloitte and Touche, I think expensive.
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair and Representative Green, the department did give us a fiscal note, and again, we may need to just talk to them because the bill really only goes so far as to do the upfront analysis, and the vendor does that at cost. So there isn't an external contracting cost in this initial phase in what you call opportunity identification phase. However, downstream from that, there would be a separately negotiated contract with the outside party, or the state would determine how to use them. And so at that point, there could be costs. The department did book some costs, again, which I thought were a little high because the vendors will come in and extract data and go off and do their analysis and spend time on site. The department, I think, if I remember, it was maybe two FTEs for 2 years, and this would probably be the initial upfront phase would literally be done in 3 months, maybe 6 months.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick follow-up, and actually I have kind of two quick follow-ups just to warn you. One is, what was the exact cost listed in the note, and was it in the form of FTEs or money or both?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, I'm working off of memory. It was in the $220,000 per year in the biennium, and I believe it was two FTEs, and maybe Mr. Allen has the... it was pretty good. Madam Chair, $222,000 in fiscal year 12, $213,000 in fiscal year 13, and it was two FTEs for that two-year period.
Representative Green.
Thank you. And the next question is, is there any discussion of potentially, or let me ask, is the possible consultant that we partner with exempted, or I shouldn't say exempted, excluded from then bidding on the contracts that they themselves think that we could pay for if we found somebody else to do them?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, Representative Green, actually it's the reverse. Assumption is that if a vendor came in at risk on their dime to identify the opportunities, that vendor would be one that would be allowed to propose and pursue the opportunities. I did want to mention, and I know I think everybody on the DFL side voted against my previous provision that would allow our existing collective bargaining units to propose on this. If by chance that provision would somehow pass, I can't remember who mentioned, it was Mr. Allen himself mentioned the possibility of our state team proposing on the work. And if they had the technology tools and the analysis capabilities and things to compete for that business, this would be a case where I fully would expect and hope that if my legislation were to pass, that the collective bargaining unit would be able to propose on this. And who knows, they might be the absolute best group to do it.
Thank you.
Representative Green.
One last comment, and I think it's a comment, not a question. It's just, it smells a little bit like a conflict of interest. Like, if we have people bidding on contracts that they themselves might get, but describing the need for and pointing out the savings and so on, it just seems a little self-serving potentially.
A lot self-serving.
Madam Chair.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Green. That's a great observation, and there are multiple strategies for kind of iterative consulting contracts like this. And one is to say that the person who does the strategy and the design and the opportunity identification would not propose on the downstream phases, and therefore you have a totally independent perspective, one that is giving the state objective and unbiased advice. There's another set of contract types, and this I think would be most appropriate for this kind, where the incentive to actually find and realize the savings is what really compels the vendor to participate in the first place. And so this is a contract type that would typically be a share and savings kind of contract as compared to the other type.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And originally wanted to speak, and I see Representative Beard is not here now. I want to respond to a little bit of what he was saying. And while everything that he said, I agree with most of it. What about we want to encourage other democracies around the world and other people. But I think the concern we have on our side of the aisle about contracting this out, and we're going to China or any place, even in North or South Dakota, is that part of the reason why we spend state dollars is to help spur our state economy. And if we're sending dollars that we raise in taxes here to North or South Dakota or China or India or someplace else for services, that's money that's not going to circulate in our local economy, not going to go to the local grocer, to the local tire store, to the local sheet mill company to do work here. And so it's actually a net hurt on our economy, and that's what I'm hearing all the time from the businessmen in my community and my constituents, that they're seeing when this work goes elsewhere, they're not getting a chance to bid on it or to get that work. And even though it may be a little bit cheaper going someplace there, the net effect of it being in the local economy actually has a greater effect on our economy. And so I guess that's part of that. That was one of the things I wanted to say to Representative Beard, but unfortunately he's not here to hear it. But I do have a couple questions on the bill, and that we've been brought up as we're talking here. The concept I like, because it's always good to have somebody look at what you're doing. It's not a bad idea, but sometimes that can be done internally, as Mr. Allen talked about, from the people inside. I know when I worked in the past at a public agency, we had a contract that for supplies that we used on a daily basis, and there was a little piece that had service along with it. And because of that little service agreement that was attached to the contract, the wholesalers in this community would not bid on the contract because they didn't want to compete with their retail outlets that were out there that they were selling to. And so we were ending up paying 30% more. And at the one time, the wholesaler was on one end of the block, and the retailer that we went to was on the other end of the block. We'd bring our requests for the material that were in our purchase orders, and they'd say 1 second, they'd walk out the door, walk down the block, go and get it from the wholesaler, walk back, and charge us 30% more. We pointed this out to the people in the procurement part and our supervisors, and they poo-pooed us and blew us off, and it finally took us 3 years to prove to them that this is how much more it costs by going buying at retail when we were buying enough that we could get the top wholesale price. And when they switched, we went from running out of money in our account in July when the contract went to the 1st of August or 1st of October to having a surplus at the end of the year. And this was something that was done internally that the employees did. And I know there's things like that we could look at, and I can see this having a ability to do that. But it just took sometimes just looking at it. I also have a constituent that recently complained to me, that former state employee that worked on computers in the state. Now, she hasn't got back to me what department she worked in, so I can look into more directly. But she said they had a contract that they were reviewing, that the state, that they would only sign a one-year contract for service on these, or for use of, for these servers. But if they, and the one-year contract was $20,000, and if they signed a three-year contract, it would have been $26,000. So for $6,000 more, they would have got 2 more years service on these servers. And somebody, again, in the upper upper end of the administration wouldn't sign more than a one-year contract. I don't know if that's a rule that we have or if it's something, but this is a complaint she had to me. I told her to get back to me with the specifics, and because to me that makes common sense. I know to look at how we're doing things, and sometimes, like I said, the concept of having an outside person look at it. And I guess the first question I have here that has to do with this is about what I read the brief on this is that if the company doesn't find savings, they don't get paid. Is that correct, Representative Downey?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. And it looks like maybe you have a couple other questions, but I have a couple of comments in response to your comments, too. But go ahead and continue, and I'd like to come back to a couple thoughts you had.
Okay, and the other piece that I guess I'm asking, this is we're talking here for contracts for supplies and service contracts, service agreements. We're not talking employment contracts here. This is just supplies and service.
Representative Downey.
And I guess Madam Chair, yes. And if that would need to be clarified, there are categories of spend that would be included in this, and I cannot imagine that internally negotiated labor agreements would be part of that. That's not the intention.
Okay. And
Representative Nelson.
I guess, Madam Chair, the other question I have is, again, looking at things, and it kind of this ties off what Representative Green asked about, who's going to measure the savings? Because I could come in and say, I'm going to save you this much money, and this is what it is, and this is how I'm going to get. And if we don't realize those savings, who is there a clawback provision that we pay, you know, Joe's consulting, and Joe's consulting really doesn't get us any savings. It still costs us the same amount of money, but now he's got this contract to provide the service. Is there a way to claw back that money, though, that we that they claim we should have saved? Or I guess that's my 3 a.m. Brain is not quite awake yet either. So,
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nelson. Those are great questions, and the structuring of these contracts is a precise one, and the exact nature of the success fee payment. Typically, there's some caps. Typically, there's a a de-escalation. As the savings get bigger, the percent paid to the contractor goes down, and typically there's some caps on that. I just don't want to prescribe here or intimate here in this hearing that I know exactly how that would be structured, but there are ways to do this and lots of protections for the state to make sure that we don't overpay the vendor but fairly compensate them for the value that they've produced. And it's not easy, and Mr. Allen pointed to a couple places where it's failed. Typically that's because we just didn't write the contracts precisely enough. And Madam Chair, can I just get back to two other comments from Representative Nelson, because they're really good ones, I think.
Okay, Representative Downey, if you could keep it short, we do have one more person that has asked to have some questions, and then I'd like to go to a vote.
Such an exciting topic. You know.
It is, truly.
So you hit the nail on the head in terms of trying to figure out where you should and shouldn't outsource, and every organization has to think about what's their core competency, and it typically is in the really large scale, high volume activities where you can effectively contract out, or it's the one-off activities where you don't have the internal specialty skills or the systems that a company that literally has thousands of people in their department, you know, doing this stuff for a living. So I think this fits one of those areas. And you brought up this concept about like wholesale versus retail, and this is one thing people never think about. This you always would think, gee, if we go for the retail or for the wholesale price, we're saving money. But there are techniques to actually analyze whether or not the cost of carrying that inventory and the inflexibility of bulk purchasing is right. And I don't want to get into it. It's exponential smoothing and seasonality analysis and all kinds of things that these high-end systems will look at. Whether you got central supply, whether you keep it distributed, all of these are strategy decisions that these folks that come in and look at your overall procurement environment help you make good decisions on to hopefully optimize service and the dollar. So you raised some really good points about how to analyze that, and I think that's the value of the outside consultant coming in.
Representative Nelson, are you done, or did you have a follow-up?
I guess I just maybe a follow-up comment, and I understand that too, and they said this situation where I mentioned about this kind of wholesale versus retail. We were buying one at a time. They were keeping the merchandise, so we were buying, but we were getting their best wholesale price. And in another situation similar to that, we had to buy a large, I think it was 700 or plus of an item that we needed to do as door closures that we need to install on the doors of the building. But if we bought 1,200 of them, we got a better enough price that we only were paying for 500 of them. And it's, you know, those are things that, again, we should be looking at in situations. So, I mean, yeah, there's, you have to look at that, and it's something that I understand what you're talking about there.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And just real quickly on the subject of outsourcing, it doesn't specifically apply to this, but a little bit of a general sense, I want to make this point because outsourcing has been mentioned. Last month, a few of us, along with the governor, went to Hutch Tech to talk to them about the closing of part of their plant and letting go 600 workers. And we want to know why this is happening. And we expected to get answers when we met with the CEO of the company, having to do with taxes in Minnesota and having to do with permitting. But he said, no, there's nothing that the state of Minnesota could have done. We now have a global economy. When Hutch Tech started in 1965, 100% of their business was in the United States. 98% of their business is now in Asia. And their customers demanded that they be closer to the people they do business with. And that's why Hutch Tech let 600 people go in Hutchinson, why they are still doing their manufacturing in, and they do, by the way, suspension hard drives for computers. And they do their manufacturing now in Eau Claire simply because they have a more modern plant there. And their business, their other plant is in Bangkok, Thailand, and that's where they're doing most of their work because it's close to their customers.
Okay, we have, this is the last question, and then we're going to come to a vote. And we've had just a long time to debate this issue. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Allen, does the state of Minnesota presently aggregate across product lines with each vendor in order to reach a level of volume to hit better price points?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, we do. In fact, Minnesota actually manages the two largest state purchasing cooperatives or consolidated purchasing pools that operate anywhere in the nation. I mean, we manage a multi-state computer contract that all 50 states use. We have an aggregated prescription purchasing program that 46 states choose to use. So, I mean, yes, I'm not saying that in every area where it could conceivably be done, we have done it, but we've certainly looked at the key spend areas and have made efforts in all of those spend areas.
Okay. Representative Murray will renew his motion that House File 1234 be passed and re-referred to State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Nay. Motion does prevail.
You just did it because you don't want to hear it again.
Okay. Next on the agenda, House File 429, Representative Detmer. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As everyone's coming up to the table, I'd like to move House File 429. Be recommended to pass and be sent to the Taxes Committee.
Representative Sanders moves House File 429 be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on Taxes. To your bill, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Chairman Pepin and Committee. I also have an author's amendment if Representative Sanders would also pass that.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move the A11-0251 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and again, with the House File 429, I guess sometimes as a state representative, you learn what's going on in other parts of your district. I do represent the eastern part of Anoka County, and they approached me a few weeks ago regarding this. I didn't know that back in 2002, I don't know how many of you were here in 2002. How many were here in 2002? Okay. In 2002, a special law was passed permitting Anoka County to bond for 800 megahertz system benefiting all public safety agencies in the county. This law needs to be updated to permit bonding for other countywide public safety purposes, including updating the law enforcement record system, which is fully integrated into the Central Communications 911. And the revision broadens the public safety purpose from simply a communication system that requires approval, and it also requires approval from Anoka County Joint Law Enforcement Council. And in addition to the county, it extends the sunset date in the law. Now, with that, over the past few weeks, there's been community meetings have been conducted and on House File 429. And the proposed public safety project. To date, there's been presentations of 11 of the 21 communities in Anoka County. All 11 have passed the resolutions. I have copies of some of the resolutions in support of the legislation of the project. And there's also a plan for presentations in the 10 remaining cities in the county between now and May 2nd, 2011. And all the communities that have passed the resolutions are Andover, Blaine, Centerville, Circle Pines, Fridley, Ham Lake, Lionel Lakes, Oak Grove, Ramsey, St. Francis, and Spring Park. And with me today, I have two testifiers. I have Anoka County Attorney Tony Palumbo and also Anoka County Commissioner Rhonda Savaraja. So I'd like to turn that over to them.
Representative Detmer, did you want to just address the amendment and then to have him address the whole bill after that? Would that be appropriate?
Well, the amendment is just to bring the language in line with the Senate version.
Okay, I think I'd like to address that issue first before they testify, if that would be okay. Does anybody have any questions strictly to the amendment? Okay. We'll vote on the amendment then. All those in favor of the A11-0251 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment does prevail. And then we will turn it over. Please welcome to the committee and please state your name for the tape.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tony Palumbo. I am the Anoka County Attorney, and I am here today to speak in favor of House File 429 as amended this morning. It does amend the general statute of 383E.21, which is Anoka County statute, which, as has been described earlier, was our bill passed or statute passed in 2002 to allow us to bond for an 800 megahertz system. I am here also in my role as chair of the Joint Law Enforcement Council. Just by way of information, the Joint Law Enforcement Council is a joint powers board. It was created in 1970. It is comprised of 31 members, including the chiefs of police of all the law enforcement communities within Anoka County. In addition, it has a fire representative. It has elected officials from the member cities, and it has elected officials from Anoka County government. Throughout those 40 years, the Joint Law Enforcement Council has collaborated to provide some of the best public safety services for the citizens of Anoka County. For example, it has collaborated on the 911 dispatch center in Anoka County. We have one public safety answering point. It is located in the basement of the government center or the courthouse, and it does do dispatching for all police and fire and emergency medical throughout Anoka County. In addition, the Joint Law Enforcement Council has collaborated on the major crimes investigations. It has collaborated on training for public safety partners throughout Anoka County. In addition, it has collaborated on the 800 megahertz system, which, of course, was the 2002 law that is being amended or sought to be amended this morning. In addition, it has participated in an auto theft grant, which I'm proud to say has reduced auto thefts in Anoka County within the last 5 years by 62%. We are again attempting to collaborate, in this time to create a public safety data system. This system would connect law enforcement agencies throughout Anoka County. It is a collaboration meant to increase efficiencies among all the public safety partners. We currently have a records management system that is over 12 years old. We are seeking to update that management system and to upgrade it so that we could connect those law enforcement agencies throughout Anoka County. There are 11 police agencies and the sheriff's office, fire departments, our 911 dispatching center, our emergency management system, as well as our jail. This records system, we believe, or this public safety data system, would avoid unnecessary duplication of efforts. Every time a partner in the public safety system comes in contact with a specific situation or an individual, they have to re-enter data that other departments have gathered. And when you have to do that, unfortunately, there are errors made. They're entered by humans, errors are made, and we create what is called a suspense file, which means the record that is erroneously created does not get attributed to the individual. By implementing this particular system, we feel it is an excellent example of creating efficiencies among all the public safety partners, as well as avoiding some of the mistakes. And at this time, if the committee has any questions, happy to answer them, or I have witnesses who from the law enforcement and fire community that can speak to specifics about this. If not, I would ask the chair of the Anoka County Board, Commissioner Rhonda Sivaraja, to address the committee.
Okay, I think I'll have Commissioner Sivaraja testify, and then we'll take a question. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rhonda Sivaraja. I am chair of the Anoka County Board of Commissioners. And I think over the years, many of our citizens have become frustrated by what seems to be the silos in government, where one hand doesn't seem to know what the other hand is doing. And sometimes there seems to be duplication of efforts. In Anoka County, we have recently launched an effort to have a collaborative effort for school districts, cities, as well as the county, to look for greater efficiencies, how we may be able to share services, and even possibly equipment. Fortunately, our public safety community has been working together in a collaborative manner for the past 40 years in order to more efficiently bring public safety to the general public. This project is really an example of what our citizens should come to expect from government. It reduces duplicate efforts across agencies and jurisdictions through shared services and collaboration, not only with police, fire, jail, dispatch, and emergency management, but also the cities, one township, and county government. The system would eliminate redundant data entry and provide for complete integration, and would bring together really an economy of scale for greater cost savings. For example, there was one metro area city that recently, just for the computer-aided dispatch and the record management system for police and fire, for one community spent $1.8 million in order to get those services. We are estimating, and we're still going through a needs assessment, that the total price tag countywide for all jurisdictions, and in addition adding in jail and emergency management, would be about $3.5 to $5.5 million. So again, looking at reducing the cost by going with economies of scale. This bill would also allow for greater transparency by having it listed as a separate line item on the property tax statement. You know, we recognize that a taxpayer is a taxpayer, and there's a lot of work and effort that goes into creating formulas to assess cities and say, okay, this is your share to pay, this is your share to pay. Makes a whole lot more sense for all of us to work together for Anoka County to move forward with issuing the bonds and having it issued as a separate line item so that citizens really know what their dollars are going for. So I would ask for your support of this legislation so that local government can provide needed public safety improvements in a cost-effective, efficient, collaborative manner, which I would contend is something that the public expects and frankly deserves.
Thank you. We'll go on to member questions. Representative Nelson. Oh, you didn't have a question. I'm sorry, you were on my list. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, County Attorney Palumbo and Commissioner Sivaraja. I'm inclined to support the bill. It sounds like you're doing great things. I just have a question, though, a quick question about the county budgeting. As I understand this, this is essentially a request for us. I mean, we're sort of leaving the policy to you. This is just authorizing you to take on some more debt. Is that basically it? Take on debt and change the terms by which you manage the current debt.
Commissioner Sivaraja.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. Actually, we have the capacity to take on additional debt. What this would allow is for there to be a separate line item on the property tax statement, and it would also be outside of levy limits, should those be in place in years to come during that time period, because this really is a model throughout the state. We are one county that has been working together for the past 40 years in the public safety environment, and I think, frankly, it's a model that other communities could replicate.
Representative Simon.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I'm just reading from that, and forgive me, I'm not an expert on municipal or county finance, but I'm looking at the nonpartisan House research summary here by Ms. Dyson. The first bullet point says about the bill, it expands the purposes for which bonds may be issued. Is that accurate?
Commissioner Sabraja.
Madam Chair, Representative, it does not, within this particular statute, it expands what this statute would allow for the bonds to be issued for. The county could issue bonds on its own. However, there would not be the separate line item to indicate that this is a collaborative effort. The current statute, I believe, specifically allows for communication system infrastructure, and what we're looking is to have that to be public safety improvements and equipment. So that's the difference in what we're asking for.
Representative Simon. So it does expand it from communications to something broader, public safety, right?
Commissioner Sabraja.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, in this particular statute.
The second bullet, the second bullet point here of Ms. Dyson's nonpartisan House research summary says that it modifies the cap on the amount of principal that may be issued to limit it to an outstanding principal amount of $12.5 million. So you're in essence raising the cap because you're excluding certain amounts from that cap. Is that true? Is the summary correct?
Commissioner Sabraja.
Madam Chair, Representative, the current state statute, I believe, had no cap. However, our public safety communication 800 megahertz system, we issued $10 million worth of bonds. After discussion with some of our representatives and senators, they indicated they would be more comfortable with having a cap in place, and we are very satisfied with having a cap in place.
Okay, but
Representative Simon.
What, I'm not quite clear what the bill does to the cap. Does it make it higher, lower, change the definition? This says modifies the cap, and maybe I just need some more. What does it do to the cap? And maybe Mr. Palumbo can answer that as well. I just want to make sure I'm understanding. What, if anything, does this bill do to the debt cap?
Commissioner Sabraja.
Madam Chair, Representative, it keeps a cap in place, which is the same as what was in the 2002 law. However, it broadens what that can be utilized for.
Okay. So it allows, Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. So it allows more to fit in under that cap, in essence? Or it excludes certain monies from being included with that cap. Is that the better way to put it?
Commissioner Sabraja.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that's correct.
Okay. And then the final bullet point, I'm skipping it. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. The final bullet point says that it extends the county's authority to issue debt under this law so that it expires January 1st, 2027, instead of 2012. And I see that out of the amendment. So instead of the expiration of this authority to take on debt being a year from now, it's now going to be 16 years from now. Is that true? Is that an accurate statement in the
Commissioner
summary?
Sabraja.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct. Our current 800 megahertz authority expires in 2012. And so as the 800 megahertz is coming off of the property tax system, this would be something that would be coming on. However, currently what the citizens on an average $200,000 home are paying for the 800 megahertz system is approximately $7.
Okay.
With this, we're estimating that they would pay about $3.50 to $4 on that same house. So that would come online in 2013.
Madam Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. And Commissioner, thank you for your patience. I appreciate it. I want to say I'm going to vote for the bill. I think you're doing great things with public safety. You're right about government being in silos. I particularly appreciate that you're putting in the separate line item so that consumers or citizens can see what they're getting. But I just have to say, I think this is somewhat of a teachable moment. This is an example of what people and families and governments do in tough times or when they want to do new things. They don't. Living within your means means more than just spending what you got. Real families in Minnesota, in St. Louis Park, in Hopkins, in all of our districts, they do more than just cut spending. They take on debt. They take on loans. They put stuff on credit cards. They ask relatives for help. They'll try to get revenue by selling a car or a lake home or an asset of some kind or a family heirloom. That's what real people that I know do. So this bill is very timely in terms of our budget debates because it shows that this sort of empty, hollow line of live within your means in the real world, not in the fantasy kind of think tank world, in the real world, real people and real governments, apparently in Anoka County, say, we don't have enough money to do the things we want to do, however great they may be. And these projects sound fantastic. And Mr. County Attorney, I'm glad that you're cooperating with the other folks as well to make these happen. And Commissioner, good for you for the underlying policy. It sounds like you're really doing cutting-edge things. But this is a perfect example, members, of where a county is coming to us saying, we need more money. We need to borrow. We need to extend by 16 years the timeline for our borrowing. We need to expand our debt ceiling by excluding certain amounts. We need more money. And they're coming to us, and they're asking us for us to do this for them. And I'm going to do it for them. They should be able to do it. But I hope this is a real instructive moment for all of us, that real people and real governments do more than just cut spending. They borrow, and they get revenue. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Are there any other questions? Representative Beard.
If I can comment to the teachable moment, the difference between businesses and families and government is huge. See the guy sitting up there with guns and badges on? They represent the government. So if we need more money as a government, we go take it from people. That's the big difference. When I need more money at home, I get down to Walmart and get a job as a greeter, make a little more money. And I do that voluntarily. And I don't compel Walmart to, I don't take their money, I earn it. But whenever we as government want to raise money, sometimes we have to send the sheriff with a gun and a badge to take it from people. That's the rest of the teachable moment. Thank you for indulging me.
Okay. Representative Murray.
Madam Chair, just a little bit more on the teachable moment. As long as we're on that, last Saturday I sat down, I'm a financial advisor by trade, and sat down with a couple in Albert Lea who borrowed from family, put money on credit cards, took out more loans, and will be seeing their lawyer this year or next week about going through bankruptcy. And so it doesn't always work out to put it on the credit card and to borrow it and to get it from families because maybe you can't pay it back. So let's keep that in mind, too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that needed to testify to this bill? Are there any other member questions? Okay. Well, hearing none, Representative Sanders renews his motion to that House File 429 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
House File 962 we're going to take up next. Representative Howes. Just a refresher on this bill. We've already fully vetted this bill in this committee, and I had received a note that Chair Gottwald wanted to hear the bill. Representative Howes was a bit surprised by that since he hadn't heard anything, so I apologize. There must have been a miscommunication, and it was my understanding that Representative Gottwald did want to hear the bill and Health and Human Services policy. He did not. The motion had originally been to pass the bill and put it on the general register. We had to transfer it back on the floor because of that misunderstanding. So we're back here. My intention would be, and my motion will be to that House File 962 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. And again, we've already fully vetted this, so my intention is to not spend a lot of time on this since we've already, I think, spent quite a bit of committee time on it. So Representative Howes, if you just want to refresh our memory on what the bill does, and then we'll go from there.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. You explained it well. I suppose I could explain it again. It's I won't say it's a simple bill, because the minute anybody says that, I always get suspicious. But it deals with violations in selling cigarettes to minors, and it simply gives municipalities options to do things differently if they want, but it doesn't change what they can currently do with regard to the first, second, or third penalty of a violation. And that's the basic gist of the whole bill.
Representative Hornstein.
Madam Chair, I guess I just want a little bit more explanation about the procedure here, because we were on, I think there was some understanding that the Health Committee was going to see it. This is clearly an issue that has a lot of health implications. So what exactly happened? Representative Gottwald decided he didn't want to hear it? And just a little unclear about what happened here.
Representative Hornstein, during committee, I think the original motion that we made, I can't remember who made the motion during committee, was to place the bill, be recommended to pass, and be placed in the general register. During the committee, I received a note, which I believed was from Representative Gottwald, asking for him to renew the motion and change it to Health and Human Services policy. We did that. We changed the motion. We re-referred it to Health and Human Services policy. After the committee, we found out that Representative Gottwald, that was not his note, that was not his intention, and he did not want to hear the bill, did not feel it had to do with health policy. It had more to do with the more of a issue with, I don't know, I guess you'd commerce, or I don't know what you'd say. And so he did not want to see it, and so the motion was made, and on the House floor, I don't know, I can't remember what day that was, and both Representative Gottwald and I agreed. Representative Howes made the motion on the floor to refer it back to this committee, and that's where it stands.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, then one more question.
Representative Hornstein.
I see that it hasn't gone to Commerce. You mentioned that it seems to have some issues related to that. So is there a reason why we wouldn't want to send this? I know we had heard testimony from, you know, the Super Americas and the convenience stores, and that's certainly a function of commerce. Is there a reason why we wouldn't want to do that?
Representative Powell
mentioned it, so you kind of gave me the idea, Madam Chair. So
Representative Powell has Chair Hoppe requested to hear the bill. Maybe you want to comment on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Horstein. No, this doesn't deal with commerce. It deals with a transaction where someone sold a product that could only be sold to an adult rather than a minor. It's very specific in what it deals with, and it deals with the penalty phase that the municipality uses when there's a violation. It doesn't have anything to do with commerce. And for the record, Madam Chair, when Representative Gottwald asked for the bill, a lobbyist or a lobbying group told him that he must see it. It was germane to his committee. He read the bill 15 minutes later and said he had no need or interest in seeing it. It did not affect or relate to his committee at all. He was not very happy that someone lied to him.
Nor was I.
Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the reason that it's here is because this is a license that a city grants to a particular vendor. So that's why it would have to go through local government.
Right.
And I know the comments were made at the last meeting that we're not punishing the people who actually do the selling, but the only purview of this committee is the licensing process between the city or the local government and the vendor. And if they default on their license provisions, then that's why the state has the provisions to determine what those defaults might be. It's a licensing issue in this committee.
Correct.
With local governments.
Correct. And Representative Green, do you have a question?
Thank you. I'm sure this was covered the last time, so I apologize. I remember it being a little bit confusing. Could you tell me what is the current law if a fake ID is used?
Well, Representative House.
Madam Chair, Representative Green, it has a lot to do with more than just a fake ID. It could be a mistake that the clerk didn't ask for an ID, assumed the person was 21, or they were extremely busy, had two cash registers going, something wrong at the gas pump outside, one had to run out there frantically trying to fix everything, and someone ordered three candy bars and a pack of cigarettes, and here it's $10, and they forgot to check the ID. That's basically what this bill deals with. And then municipalities have to meet the minimum standard of state law, but they can go beyond that if they so desire. This bill does not restrict them from going beyond that. To put it real simple, if there's a violation and they meet before this municipality, the municipality says, was there a violation? The only thing they can do basically right now is say yes or no. They can't say yes because this happened. That's what we want them to be able to do. So if it was done in some fashion that really wasn't, someone literally tried to scam the system and sell cigarettes to a minor.
I guess I'm just concerned because I feel like the current law allows for some flexibility. My understanding is that it's three strikes, it's at the same three strikes at the same location, and those three strikes need to be within 24 months, 2 years. So that sounds, I don't know, pretty, I don't want to say loose, but, you know, like things would be all right.
Representative Howes.
I'm Chair Representative Green. In some respects, you're correct, but a municipality can go beyond that. That's the state standard. They could suspend the license in the first or second violation. They could intentionally go to a convenience store in three times in 2 weeks, purposefully going at a time when they're very busy and frantic at the store and do that. And there are instances of where there are stores now that are actually breaking that regulation and not even punishing some of these. So it's municipalities do pretty much how they want to do it, but they have to meet the minimum standard that the state sets forward.
And so if this is the minimum standard, so and it sounds like you would, thank you, I'm sorry, that you agree that it's, you know, allows for some latitude, municipalities can make it stronger if they want, why do we need to change it?
Madam Chair, Representative Green, because when there's a violation and you go before the municipality, your only answer to was there a violation is yes. You can't go into explanation that we train our employees, we do our own sting operations, we're very careful. But on that particular day, this happened. Please don't take away our license they would have to pay the fine according to state law on the first offense, but you know, some municipalities could suspend their license on the first offense just because. This way, they still can, but they can say, why was there a violation? And in some instances, mistakes are made. We're all human.
I guess just a
Representative Green.
It's not a question, it's just a comment. I don't believe in a kind of paternalistic government, but I do feel as though if somebody is selling a substance that is bad for people's health, that has enormous public cost to it, I don't mind consequences.
Representative Howes, do you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, would you like me to comment on it?
Okay, no, sorry, never mind. Madam Chair, may I ask for a roll call?
Representative Green has asked for a roll call. There will be a roll call.
Real quick.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Green, you're not implying you would sue McDonald's if you ate too many cheeseburgers and get fat, are you?
Are they addictive?
Madam Chair, Representative Green, I understand your concern, and we pass all kinds of laws and rules and regulations to prevent bad things from happening. We're not, with this bill, we're not changing what municipalities can do. We're not telling them you can't punish these people any more than state law. We're not telling them they can't punish people. We're just telling them that they can ignore this bill if they want, but it gives them some comfort that they can ask the owner of the establishment what happened. And if you look at, and to be fair, okay, I'll bring up another topic. Wally the beer man refused to accept the penalty. He went to court. He was exonerated. But why did they go after Wally the beer man? Why didn't they go after Target Field and take away their liquor license? Because they were the violators. Wally the beer man was simply an employee. Why wouldn't that relate to a pack of cigarettes in a convenience store? It's the same basic idea. And all we're doing is saying you have some flexibility if you so desire.
Representative Hancock?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Comment and then perhaps a question. I don't think any of us here are advocating that we want our young people to smoke. This is not from smoking myself. This is laryngitis from from a cold I've been battling for a couple of days. Actually, a couple of weeks. But I don't think any of us are advocating that. I am going to support this legislation, and I've gotten some information that, you know, people view this as we're being more lenient on establishments and smokers, and that's not, I think, what we're saying. Mm-hmm. We're saying is we want to give control to the local enforcement agencies and to the local courts to have an option. And where they want to be more strict, they have an option to do that. So this, to me, is not advocating a position. This is just saying what we're really doing. I guess that would be the question. That's how I would interpret this, is that we are giving local authorities a chance to use common sense and good judgment in how they address a situation, both for the employer and for the employee. And I think that's what good jurisprudence is, and I think that's what giving good local authority is as well. I guess there's no question in there. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Green, just to give you a little bit more background on the topic from our previous discussion, I have some firsthand experience with this as being involved in a municipality where we have had violations through different enforcement efforts. And the city that I'm involved with has adopted the city state standards, and what's happened is when an individual is gone through a compliance check and we get the report, what ends up happening is we are asking, allowed really to only ask one question, and that question is, did or did not the violation occur? And if the answer is yes, the violation occurred, then state statute is pretty clear as to what we should be doing or the efforts that we should be undertaking. The challenge that we have, and I brought it up last time, is that sometimes you may have an employee who's on a program of remediation within their place of employment. That remediation is not going well, and that individual may choose to step outside the boundaries of the law, which obligates the employer, and the employer is trying very hard to sustain the employment of an individual, but that individual has made a decision. What Representative House is looking to do is to just add some different options in there when it's appropriate to be able to take that step. I don't think, as Representative Hancock said, anybody is trying to legitimize or promote or do anything to expand the use of tobacco. It's simply allowing for an opportunity for some opportunities when it seems to make sense that there's some mitigating circumstances. And again, we're in a situation right now, if the answer is yes, case closed, moving forward. And I think that Representative House is just looking for the opportunity to be able to inject into the system a little bit of common sense that otherwise might not exist. And as he's pointed out, municipalities can and do adopt standards that are more stringent than what the state statute is at this time as well.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it appears to me that rather than the three strikes and you're out, it could be four, five, or six strikes and you're out. So, I mean, I think state law was written for a reason, and we've followed this in my city for years. I worked on it for years on the city council. We're just changing it from three strikes and you're out. We're making it four, five, and six.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember last time I know the bill hasn't changed, but there was some conversation about this whole definition of a sincere mistake, and we went back and forth. I was wondering, and I think, as I recall, Representative House, you even felt like maybe you needed some better language or more precise language. I'm wondering if in the intervening time, you know, that's still an open question and an issue here.
Senator House.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, just because it was you that asked me, I will come up with a different word. I guarantee it.
Thank you. And then one other question.
Representative Hornstein.
I was trying to understand a little bit more the exact number of outlets that are affected by this. It seems like most of the convenience stores and other purveyors of these products are in compliance. There's no issue. Isn't it just a small number that are the repeat violators?
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, yes, it is a small number. There are those I'm not aware of, but I know of one, but I don't want to mention a provider or a name of a business, but that do repeatedly offend. This certainly isn't going to help them at all, and they probably will still try to skirt the system. It's the odds are the compliance checks. Do they get to them on the day that they're doing that? No, but it's the ones that might just by accident once in 10 years make that mistake that just gives the municipality opportunity to look at it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of have a concern that there's good that's been done that we're now kind of messing with, so to speak. I think statistics show that teenage smoking has been reduced. I think that taking a hard line on this has been effective. These laws have been in effect since 1997. Convenience stores and local municipalities know the laws. They know how to abide by them. It sounds like municipalities also know that they can make them stronger if they want to, so there's flexibility there. They're also easy to enforce. This is simply about recognizing which color-coded driver's license means that a customer is 18. So in terms of kind of the older possible staff person who can't tell from the license if the person is really eligible to buy cigarettes, it's pretty foolproof. I know last time we talked about this bill, we had some extended and kind of amusing discussions about the possible weaknesses of somebody who might be trying to check IDs, and really there was, it seems as though systems are in place, things have been designed such that we would catch problems, and that's why these laws are in place the way they are. Another great statistic is that in 1996, only 69% of Minnesota retailers passed compliance checks, and now 95% of them do so. So again, it seems as if something's worked and now we want to go backwards, and I would question why we want to do that. I know we've talked a lot with Representative Downey about kind of picking things that work and doing those, choosing those routes through legislation, and I just wonder why we would want to take something that's really been effective and essentially dismantle it.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, a roll call has been requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin?
Aye.
Representative Murray? Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Beard?
Aye.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Hancock?
Aye.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative McFarland? Representative O'Driscoll?
Aye.
Representative Quam? Representative Sanders?
Aye.
Representative Scalzi?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Erdahl?
Aye.
Representative Winkler?
There being 6 ayes and 5 nays, the motion does prevail, and the bill is passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
We have one final bill.
Well,
Representative Hancock, House File 1139. Representative Hancock, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 1139 to the General Register, pass, recommend that it pass, move to the General Register. And I do also have an amendment that I would like to move at this time as well.
The A1 amendment, Representative Hancock?
Yes, it would be the A1 amendment.
Representative Hancock moves the A1 amendment. To your amendment.
The amendment, thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment, and representatives, amendment basically is just some cleanup language that complies with the Senate version and makes minor changes.
Any questions to the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment does prevail to your bill.
Again, caution to say anything is non-controversial, but I think this is a relatively non-controversial bill. What it really does is it authorizes local governments the opportunity in acquiring lease or purchase public safety equipment for fire departments to use a sole source acquisition for the purchase of used equipment if there is clearly and legitimately basically only one source. And at that point, it's best to establish a price by direct negotiations. It also allows a local government to issue certificates of indebtedness or capital notes to acquire new or used public safety equipment by lease for a term of up to 15 years. Under current law, the maximum term for a certificate or note is 10 years, and it is only for purchase, not leasing. This exempts the debt from debt limits and election requirements. Madam Chair, I do have Bill Straczynski here representing the fire departments, fire marshals, and fire chiefs. If I don't know if he would like to testify or just answer questions if there may be some.
Welcome to the committee if you want to say just a word.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. What we're trying to fix here
Please state your name for the tape.
I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the Minnesota Fire Marshals Association, the Fire Chiefs Association, Fire Departments, Arson Investigators, and a few other fire groups. Madam Chair and members, this bill is pretty straightforward. We're trying to accomplish two things. Number one, purchase used equipment on a sole source basis so we can negotiate a lease or a purchase of that particular piece of equipment. And let me describe that to you. Typically what happens, we're looking at equipment, even a used ambulance is about $250,000 sometimes. Fire trucks run in the range of $500,000 for used equipment, up to $1 million. And it's difficult to find this equipment, but it has a useful life of 30 years sometimes. Might only have 6,000 miles after 10 years or 20 years. But basically it enables us in the fire departments to, once they identify a piece of used equipment, say it costs $500,000. Akron, Ohio has a piece of equipment, a fire truck that's got the right kind of equipment, ladders, snorkel equipment, or what have you. It would enable the fire department, Blaine, Minnesota, for example, to go out and purchase that because they know where that equipment is, it meets their needs, and they could then purchase that used equipment and negotiate a price for it. It's really difficult to do a competitive bid situation on a used piece of equipment because it's so specialized. It's not a problem on purchasing new. The second thing that the bill does is allows municipalities to go up to 15 years on a lease purchase or a lease package. You imagine a municipality trying to issue indebtedness to purchase a piece of equipment for $500,000 or $1 million. You know, it's a spike in their revenues. It's a spike in the cost of the operating that city. This would enable them, if they want to, a management tool that enables them to flatten that cost out over 15 years because the equipment still has a useful life at least to that 15 years. And it would enable them to keep that cost relatively standard throughout each year and then proceed in the future. So it could flatten out a lot of their equipment costs. Other kinds of equipment we're thinking about is gigantic airbags that are used for lifting railroad cars off of people. We've had that happen recently. A lot of specialized equipment as it relates to automobile accidents and catastrophic events. So that's what we're talking about here, Madam Chair. We'd appreciate the committee's support.
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, this sounds like a good bill. I just have a couple concerns, and I just want to put them on the record about when you talk sole source, and I went as the way you understood it with used equipment, I can understand why that would be necessary. But this also talks about new equipment and new leases, and I guess that's just a concern I have, and I just want that on the record that if we don't, that's part, one of the reasons why we have a competitive bidding process in government, is so that we're not picking out a supplier and paying more for it, but then we have to. But I think this is a good bill, and I think we should move forward and vote on this. It's just we need to raise that concern about when we're looking at sole source, that could be problematic in the future.
Thank you. Representative Hancock?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I just want to make note that we did in the amendment. Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Representative Hancock renews his motion that House File 1139 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.